Not too recently with Henry Ferrer. And it's kind of a work in progress. It's like some we've done a couple of but we're trying some interesting things, so I thought I'd present it to you today. So something that's often assumed in cosmology is that we can coarse grain the energy density in the universe. And the dynamical and optical properties of space time should be well modeled by the result. There's good reason to suspect there might be difficulties with this. And even if it's true that the dynamical properties of space-time are well modeled by a coarse graining of the energy density, this doesn't necessarily mean the optical properties are. So to investigate whether this is true, you take a model of the space, a model of the universe which has got regularly spaced discrete masses in it. And in that model, we calculate redshifts, the orbital distances, and angular dynamic distances. And that's what I'm talking about. So this for motivation. The standard cosmology, of course, we start off by picking some matter fields, so dust and radiation, and choosing some symmetries for space-time. So homogeneity and isotropy for probability space-time as usual. Then substituting Einstein's equations to get dynamical space-time compared to observations. So of course, if we just start off with dust and radiation and FRW, then there's a large mismatch with the observations, and whatever that mismatch is called dark energy. So this is usually assumed to be an extra matter field. So this is kind of implicit in the name, actually. But it's also possible that it could be an error we made in specifying space-time symmetries, or possibly in the gravitational field. So this talks about looking at space-time symmetries. So FRW, space-time, of course, is the usual description we use in cosmology, and with good reason. So the Copernican principle is one good reason for cosmology. So this, of course, is the principle that we are a typical observer, and that other observers in other parts of the universe should see observations as large like our own. Evidence also comes from the isotropy of the CMB, and there's a theorem by Ellis, Garrett, and Sachs that says that if we see a perfectly isotropic CMB, if all observers in space time see a perfectly isotropic CMB, then it would lend uniquely to FRW, as the description of space time. And there's also evidence from other astrophysical sources as well. I can't guarantee so, basically, but there's obviously lots of astrophysical principle evidence that's consistent with FRW. So if we don't consider FRW, what are the alternatives? So we could do away with the Copernican principle wholesale, and in that case, we'd be left with a spherically symmetric space-time from the isotropy of the CFB. So you can model this with the Lemaître-Tolman bonding solution, which is a spherically symmetric dust-dominated space-time, and this is something I've been working on recently, actually looking at what observations you can do to tell the difference between an FRW universe and an LTD universe that is situated at central. Another alternative is to consider space-times that are only statistically isotropic instead of being exactly isotropic at every point. And in fact, Brayson has shown that the theorem of Ellis-Garrett and Sachs is only valid for exactly isotropic CMB. If you have a CMB that's got small anisotropies in it, this doesn't necessarily imply that the space type has to be nearly FRW. So that's what this talk is going to be about. That's based on the statistical isotropic rather than giving up the Copernican principle itself. Okay. So if you want to smooth space-time geometry, to look at space on the larger scales rather than cosmology. So if we start with many regularly spaced discrete objects such as this semi-thin grid, then if we zoom out, this is zooming out by a factor of 10, then we get something that starts to look more and more like a continuous energy density. So the question we want to ask is, does this smooth geometry that this looks like on the right-hand side have the same properties as the unsmooth space-time that this actually is on smaller scales? And the reasons why when I ask this, are the following. There's the averaging problem in general relativity, which is very difficult to define. So if you want to average an energy density over a space-like volume, And because of the particular morphism covariance of the theory, it's a very difficult procedure, it's very difficult to define in a covariant way. Of course, you can change the space-like surface by changing gauge, and the process of being very sensitive to that. There's also the back reaction problem. So even if you do find an averaging procedure that you're happy with, then in general this averaging procedure isn't going to commute with the evolution of the space-time of the space and Einstein's equations. There's then lensing effects and so forth. So lensing effects in this in the homogeneous energy density are going to be zero. You get a focusing from the energy density with zero shear. Whereas if you look at trajectories going through surface speed objects like this, you will have going through a vacuum, so they won't be focused by any energy density, but they'll experience shear as they go between these objects. So these are some good reasons to look at this problem, I think. And as I say, the way we want to address this is to look at a model that's explicitly full of discrete objects and doesn't assume any averaging at any point. So just such a model was proposed by Lindquist and Wheeler a long time ago. This was what I mentioned by George Ellis recently. And the model is a lattice model of the universe, inspired by the Wigner-Zeitz construction of electromagnetism. So the Wigner-Zeitz construction, in case you've got your undergrads, obviously, is taking a lattice of charges, which is regular, of course, and you approximate the electromagnetic field inside each of the cells as being due to the charge at the center of that cell. So this results in a potential advantage to the masses. And what was previously an intractable problem, so when solving the wave equation of an electron in a solid like this, becomes solvable because of the assumption of the electromagnetic field being due to the center charge. So the model of Lindquist and Wheeler is the analogy of this in gravitational field. So they take a surface of constant curvature, divide it into regular points, and then they put a mass at the center of each cell instead of a charge, and they approximate the gravitational field inside each of the cells as being due to the central mass. So this, in fact, so this is going to be Schwarzschild space-time, of course, because zero corresponds to a constant, and this assumes that the gravitational influences of the cell's exterior duties, of the exterior masses, is approximately spherically spectral. The main difference between the Lindquist Wheeler model and the Wigner-Zeitz model, apart from the different interaction, is that with the case of gravity, the lattice itself becomes dynamical, because the gravitational field of the boundary has a non-zero normal derivative, so the lattice itself starts to expand or collapse. So I'll just quickly run through what Lindquist and Wheeler did and what their results were before I move on to what we've been studying in this case. So Lindquist and Wheeler started off by considering a closed three space, so our hemisphere. This is a two space, of course. So the idea is you separate it into cells, like I showed you before. So we've got a cell at the front here, one to the north, one to the east, one to the south, one to the west, one on the other side, so six cells in this case. You then approximate the geometry inside each of the cells as being Schwarzschild geometry. And you allow the space to expand, so it looks like a cosmological model. So what Lindquist and Wheeler found straight away was that if they use the normal time coordinate of Schwarzschild spacetime, they then get a good description of the global expansion. And the reason for this is that if you take surfaces of constant time, like these, and you put them together on a lattice, then surfaces of constant time don't overlap at the boundary, they intersect instead in this kind of model. So what that means is that if you take a surface of constant time going through many cells, then the normal to that surface at the boundary points in different directions and you use the time coordinate of the different cells on each side of the boundary. So while this, of course, Schwarzschild time is a perfectly well-defined concept inside each cell, it's not a very good way to describe cosmological time because it doesn't agree with the time coordinate of the next cell. You have this. So the way they get around this is to look for a time coordinate that's orthogonal to a surface of constant time at all points, and in particular at the boundary, you have a surface of constant time that's orthogonal to the world line of the boundary. So they did this by constructing a new time coordinate, the ground view only, which was sufficient for their purposes, which were mainly for looking at the dynamics of the model. And they found the following, that the size of each of the cells, and therefore the lattice itself, follows the equation of this form. So this, of course, is it's got the same functional form as spatially closed FRW universe. This is the mass term FRW in this curvature, of course. M here is the Schwarzschild mass at the center, and psi is the angle subtended at the origin of the hypersphere of each of the cells. So psi is a constant in this model. It's the lattice expands, but psi stays the same. So, dynamically, these models behave very much like FRW on large scales. And in particular, as you increase the number of cells in the lattice.
Is psi constant or?
It's constant.
And how do you find that constant?
So you can, it's a geometry problem. So you can tile a hypersphere in six different ways, I think, in regular polytopes. And each of the polytopes covers a set amount of the hypersphere. So that defines an angle at the origin of it. So what they found is this. So the functional form of the evolution is the same, but the scale of the problem is different. So the maximum expansion in their model, find by the maximum expansion in the corresponding FRW model, is given by this result. So this is by a principal result of their study. It's that as you increase the number of cells, so it's a logarithmic number of cells, then the scale of the expansion approaches that of FRW. And as you get to about 1,000 cells or more, then you get a difference of less than 1%. So the expansion, the dynamics of the expansion starts to look very much like the FRW.
So that's cells per hour radius, or because you have infinite number of cells, right? So
No. Well, this is a closed space, so you can only find it with a certain number of cells.
But what is the geometry of the closed space?
It's closed.
But it would be different for tiling, not if it was a sphere or. Well, in this case, it's a.
This is for a sphere, but so we generalize it for flower like what it's space. This is the main result of the Inquiston river. The dynamics of the Inquiston Wheeler model approach those of the corresponding smooth FRW limit as the limit of very many small masses approach. So this is a very large result, and it's kind of the thing you hope to expect to have FRW as a good model of the universe. It's what we know is what happens more general geometry. So, like saying, we have an open universe thing. And in particular, for what we're interested in, is does the unsmooth space time have the same optical properties as the smooth geometry that it behaves as on the larger scales? So, to investigate this, we're going to consider bundles of null GAD6 in the lattice model. And we're going to take some astrophysical event. At some point, where a bundle of null GAD6 is focused, integrated through a number of cells, this is just 5 cells there. But for cosmological relevant distances, we're going to integrate them through thousands of cells. We're going to measure the expansion of the bundle and the shear and the redshift as we go through each of these cells, and until we get to some observer at some distance.
We use Schwarzschild. With point singularities and horizons. But you can derive Friedman, Robertson, Walker, and Friedman equations from Newtonian mechanics with Newtonian point masses. So, what if you started just with point Newtonian masses? Why do you need to use Schwarzschild?
So, if you want to do this with Newtonian cosmology, then as soon as you get to cosmologically relevant distances, you start having velocities that are approaching the speed of light as you get closer to the horizon. So, Newtonian mechanics should break down in that kind of situation. Whereas this model is valid for arbitrarily large distances. Also, you've got a problem with the time order that I was talking about before. So, if you want a cosmologically relevant time, you'd expect it to be orthogonal to the world by all of the kind of particles in it, whereas when you change the geometry with everything moving away from one point, that's not going to be the case. There are some similarities there.
What do you what do you mean by the second question about the same optical properties? Because so not exact weak condensing, for example, like video medical where you know the, I mean if I just have weak condensing at it, I know that the universe does things.
Is that
something like this?
Well, I'm going to go through that now, but there's similarities to weak-condensing also, but there's also some differences with that, I think. But the idea here is to model the background expansion rather than looking at, rather than taking it by W geometry and looking at perturbations around it.
So you're choosing your masses all identical in every side, or are you?
Yeah.
Why not just because it seems a bit.
Well, because you need the symmetry to actually do this exactly, right? If you don't have the symmetry,
it'll become much more difficult. Yeah, if you want to construct a cosmological time with an asymmetric lattice, it could be very difficult. You'd have to do some kind of very complicated tiling as well.
Yeah, I guess I'm sure it would be difficult. But are you sure you don't get sort of artifacts because you're
Oh, well, possibly. This is something we'd like to look at. Usually, definitely, is making moving away from regularity. But this is the first step.
Another issue is that if you use flexural solutions, then GR is not linear. Because you're adding up all these things.
But you don't need to do a superposition of any spacetimes here. If you've got the approximation boils down in this model boils down to the approximation of the gravitational influence of the masses external to each cell is approximately spherically symmetric. It's exactly spherically symmetric, and this is exactly Schwarzschild convergence theorem. There's likely to be some small deviations from Schwarzschild, but we're not adding up.
If that be a question, this wouldn't work. Because you wouldn't be able to add them up.
No, well, yeah. That question is very useful. Yeah. Okay, so this is the problem we're going to try and consider for the rest of the talk, is looking at the optical properties by interface. Okay, so I want to look at cosmological time and lattice. Before the analysis stage, Nicholas and Weeden constructed a time coordinate of the boundaries of the cells. We want to integrate through the bulk of the cell now as well. So we need a time coordinate that extends throughout space time as well as being orthogonal to the world line of the boundaries. So we take the geometry inside each cell as being Schwarzschild space time, it's just the usual Schwarzschild. And we then transform it into a new time coordinate tau. It's defined in this way where E is a constant. The line element then takes this form. And the reason we want to do this is because if we consider an element of the boundary, then it's going to be moving with a fault velocity at this point, where E is the same E that's introduced in the coordinate transformation here. If you then consider a vector in a surface of constant tau, any arbitrary vector like this, then these vectors are always orthogonal to the fault velocity u of the boundary. So this means that this time coordinate is orthogonal to the surface of constant time in the way that I showed you before with the lines and the arrows. So this extends the time coordinate from the boundary into the bulk of the space-time, and we've also got a new parameter e. So the results of this, if we look at the dynamics of the lattice now, are that the velocity of the boundary takes follows an equation of this form, and if you just do some relabeling, r is a, n goes to the over 2, e goes to 1 minus k, then this of course is just it's just frw. And if we take e is cos squared psi, then this result reduces to that of Lindquist arena. So e, it specifies the spatial curvature of the lattice. So,
you didn't change the Schwarzschild boundary, did you?
No, it's still Schwarzschild geometry. It's just.
But then we know that Schwarzschild geometry wouldn't be correct close to the edges of the lattice.
No, there's going to be some imperfections certainly, and in particular, so in these regions, there's some overlap, there'll be some infection. And where there's these spheres, they just stick at all, there'll be kind of some infection also, kind of in the opposite direction.
So what do you do about those
regions? So this is an approximation that's kind of built into the model. So Lindquist and Weeden argued that the the deviations in these areas are going to be opposite to the deviations in these areas and the overall measurements of precipitation. We're working a bit to look at the effect of these perturbations with control shield, just to see what the effect of that is. When we do the analysis of the optics, then we'll find there's some good reasons to believe that there is some casting of the different effects in these two different features. And I'll explain that in just a moment. Okay. So in the trajectories of the lattice, we can read the log GD6 equation straight off the metric in the usual way. And in order to propagate a bundle of log GD6 through this lattice, we don't need to just propagate them through a single cell. We need to match the boundaries between the cells as well. So to do this, it's convenient to decompose the null four vector at the boundary in the following way. So if you take a kind of approximation to this tangent vector to the trajectory, then you can decompose it into a part that's into a component that's in the direction of the observer and into a component that's orthogonal to that. So UA is the forward velocity of a congruence of time d6 that are coincident with the boundary, at the boundary, but extend throughout space time.
Sorry, I missed it. So you said during that particular boundary edges, your approximation is that you extrapolate the metric. So now your null trajectories are inevitably going to pass those regions that you estimated. So what metric are you using?
We're using short-shield geometry, but we're going to use different methods to match the trajectories at the boundary, and we're going to find that if we assume that those the effect of the deviation in those two regions cancels, then that doesn't introduce a significant error.
So practically, you're in the one short shield and then connecting to the next short shield.
Yeah.
But you can do better than that. You can bring just numerically solve. That means essentially you're solving the Laplace equation in the box.
It makes the problem a lot more difficult too because you can't do any analytic integrations anymore, which you can do in short shield geometry.
But you are doing these integrations in America, aren't you?
We're going to do lots of things you can do analytically up to a stage because it's metric space time. But we're going to end up doing numerically. We're doing just that actually at the moment. Okay, so we decompose the four vector into parts that are a tangent to the four vector with this congruence of observers and pass the orthogonal to that. That gives us this result where n is an arbitrary space like vector in the set of constant tau. So the condition to match trajectories across boundaries are then going to be that an observer on the boundary should measure the same redshift and direction in a rest space with a photon on either side of the boundary. And you can do this in two different ways. So the first method, it's going to assume that the imperfect tangency, that's what we were before, in the overlap of the no man's land regions, cancels on average. And this amounts to choosing tau dot going out of the first cell and being the same as tau dot going into the next cell. So this assumes the cancellation of Inglis and Wheeler. Hypothesized. And we're going to use a second method as well, which accounts for the imperfect tangency by allowing a small correction to trajectories as you move along each other trajectory. So the way we do that is by taking the congruence of GD6 on one side and on the other, and in these regions where the spheres overlap or don't meet, there'll be a small relative motion between the two observers. So you can correct that as a small change in redshift as you go through the boundary.
The Schwarzschild solution has a horizon, and the Schwarzschild coordinates is singular. So, what do you do to cross the horizon?
It's singular because of the time coordinate. In this new time coordinate tau, there's no, the horizon isn't singular anymore.
So you have something like Kruskal-Shekhar is called.
Well, there's no exponential here, but they go through the horizon speaking. So what it looks like is so surfaces of constant T do this. They diverge on the horizon, and the surface is a constant tau. Just stretch it out. So they're better behaved on the horizon.
So you don't have a singular horizon?
No. So it's, the species is just irregular. So it's given by this. That's a constant tau.
But if you were a massive particle, you
in as you went through the horizon?
Yeah, and you go between watching, doing different touches.
Oh, as you go through the boundary of the lattice?
Yeah.
So if you're an observer following this one of these congruences on one side of the boundary, if you were in the overlap region, you'd have a small motion towards each other, I think. And in the no man's land region, there'd be a small motion away from each other. So if you're measuring the same photon as it goes past you, you'd see a small change. There'd be a small change in motion for the congruence. Measured by the congruence one side as the other. But there shouldn't be any discontinuity for an observer who chooses to be across the boundary. If you wanted to solve this problem exactly, if you wanted to put boxes of Schwarzschild next to each other exactly, then you'd have to put domain walls in there with pressure on them. So method one is a more broad approximation. Method two takes into account the details of the matching in a slightly more comprehensive but slower way, just to match and each, depending on where the trajectory crosses the boundary. So the results of this. If we look at the redshift in the lattice, the frequency of a photon is given, as measured by an observer following u, is given by tau dot, being in a product of u and k. So the redshift is given by the ratio of tau dot emission and observation. And by new open iteration, you find the redshifts look like the following. So the x-axis here is the redshift that we measured in an FRW universe that's behaving like this lattice on large scales. And the y-axis is the actual redshift that we get integrating along the trajectories. And if we fire a trajectory, if we fire photons through along the principal axis of the lattice, then we get the two redshifts are approximately the same, not exactly, because we can't go exactly along we can't go exactly along for an axis because of the Schwarzschild masses of that. So if we have to move slightly off it, there's a small difference there. But if we pick out the third axis, then we get this line, which is approximately a gradient of 1. If we take general trajectories, however, just fire them in a random direction, then we get this kind of behavior. So this is four random trajectories. And they deviate from each other. But you can see there's a kind of a mean that they oscillate around. And if we zoom out to larger redshifts, so cosmologically relevant redshifts, then we find that these same four trajectories approach this black line and are actually distinguished from twilight if you look at redshifts in this scale. And while the on-axis relation between Z and Z in FRW is approximately 1-to-1, the relationship for trajectories shot in random directions isn't 1-to-1. A redshift would be about 2 in FRW, but a redshift is just over 1 in this plot. So the dashed line here is an analytic approximation, which I'm going to show you now.
Right, so there's a discontinuity on off-axis?
There's no discontinuity, there's different behavior. So
can you actually show it and picture what is on axis and what is off axis?
Okay, sure. So I've got access that center of each of the cells. So by point axis, I mean going in this kind of direction. So picking out symmetry of the lattice, whereas a random trajectory would be going through lattice cells, cutting them up effectively random directions each.
There's no, you think there's a palm, there's an angle.
Sorry?
You think there's a parameter that allows you to have the off axis or go towards.
A parameter to parameterize the angle?
Yes.
Something like that, yeah. Too. So
as soon as you move a little bit away from this preferred direction, though, then you start cutting cells in once you start moving through thousands, which is what this is measuring. Redshifts of one corresponds to several thousand cells, then
you take the limit of t to go to zero, you don't get that connection.
Yes, the limit of c to go to zero, you get this, but for theta being non-zero, you get you don't get out symmetry.
The Hubble distance law for redshift works very well for small zero. It's linear.
Mm-hmm.
So what you get the Hubble law for small redshifts.
Which is no use to get the
So what is that FRW?
This would be the redshift you get FRW. So this is taking what people have the analog of the scale factor, so the size of the lattice initial observation. Although there's no actual scale factor, there's no FRW direction. So we find a quite sizable difference, especially when you get to larger set.
So what direction has the maximum?
As soon as you move off axis, then you start oscillating around kind of this neat value of approach when you get to larger set. So it's not like you get a much bigger deviation because you've got a bigger angle.
What is that dashed line?
This is an approximation, which I'm going to show you in a moment.
I'm sorry, I'm forgetting on this. So you only consider the spatial bounds.
We can't fit it. We got particles going in finite directions.
It's classical general. I'm just still.
Can you clarify the horizon? So, just saying, you, in your coordinate system, you have singularity.
You've got singularity in the center, but the horizon is still singular.
Right, well, that's when you pick because you change some coordinate system.
Yeah,
you're
changing coordinates.
But the horizon is still there. There's
horizon.
So I think there is a difference if the horizon is larger or smaller than the horizon is smaller.
Oh, yeah. So we're assuming that the I should have said, we're taking the masses at the center of each of these cells to be about the mass of the Milky Way. We're taking the spacing of the cells to be about megaparsec. So the short-field radius is much, much smaller.
It's much smaller than
very much smaller. It's about 1,000 times smaller than what's
What is the mass of the Milky Way?
The mass of the Milky Way?
Yeah.
I can't put it in my head. Okay, so now we're going to parameterize the deviations that you get away from this mean of any theory approach. And what we find is for 40 random trajectories, we get this kind of relative deviation in Z from the mean value. And the trajectories approach their mean value, saying they approach it as Z becomes larger. And beyond a redshift of about 0.1, the relative difference in the redshift drops below about 1%. So when you get to redshifts between 0.1 and 1, the difference between the different trajectories, as long as they're off axis, are fairly small. And if we look at the two different methods of matching trajectories at the boundary, then if we use method 1 and method 2, then the relative difference between these two methods in terms of the redshift measured by an observer after we've done it is below 1% as long as we stay at redshift below R2. So this gives some some verification of the idea that the overlap and data science regions cancel, the effect of those cancel, because if we take into account this small redshift as trajectories pass over the boundary of those two different types of regions, then the result is indistinguishable pretty much from if we just assume they cancel already. The difference is less than 1%. Of redshifts of about 2.
And does that grow rapidly at higher redshifts?
Well, you get a small error every time you move through the boundary if you assume that the tendency is perfect.
That looks cumulative.
Yeah, so you get a small jump. As you move through each cell, you get a growing effect if you take into account this effect or if you assume that the tendency is perfect. So then the error increases.
If you ran into the CMB, would be as a how big would the error be?
We didn't run things that far. It's quite expensive to get beyond redshift but the model's going to break down well before that anyway. I mean, if you were to model these things as galaxies, then before you get to the CMB, you've got to take into account structure formation and all kinds of things. So this isn't something that's going to be up to.
Whereas, I mean, you said it was safe because it was under 100%.
Well, if you're looking at supernovae and things, they're going to be down this range.
But there could be reasons for why it's growing, and that's because you have fewer cells that are hollow radius. Because basically, these cells are constant in Kolmogorov coordinates, but then the hollow radius is smaller than Kolmogorov coordinates. So the fewer of these cells you have per hollow radius or per horizon, the larger is the error. So essentially, I think the error will blow up as you go to very early times because the size of the cells will come from the cell of the hollow radius.
I think that's what you do. Yeah. So you're getting small fluctuations that kind of accumulating a bit, and then they're going to become the fluctuations will become larger and larger. Yeah, I think that's what you do.
So, what is the
fullest
and
least
percentage of difference between F or W redshift for two chips?
So the mean was about 1 point.
Because the surface of last catcher reached 1100, it's going to be a big deviation.
Yeah, yeah. So I don't think this is a good way to. I mean, you need a much better model, I think, to go that far. We're not considering going much beyond redshift of 1. We just want to see what Hubble diagram is going to look like. Okay, so to understand what's happening, we want to make an analytic approximation to get some insight. So to do this, we find that by integrating double trajectories in the Schwarzschild space, we get the following relations. So tau dot, where dot here is d by d lambda, and lambda is their prime parameter. B here is integration constant from the Fourier equation for tau. And alpha here is defined as r dot over b. B from the Hamiltonian constraint is approximately this, so it's approximately the kind of radial velocity, if you like, in terms of lambda. And so alpha tells you the proportion of the velocity in the radial direction. So if you've got a trajectory that's moving entirely in the radial direction, alpha is 1. If you've got a trajectory that's moving in that angular direction, then alpha is 0. And it varies from 0 to 1. That's a good if we write the velocity of a shell at constant r as being root 2 m over r, that's the velocity of the observer following this congruence of Donner GP6, then we can expand in this small quantity to get the following expression in small z. So delta zi here is the redshift going through a single cell. So this is the frequency at the moment the photon comes into the cell, and then the frequency when it goes out of the cell. And by taking the ratio of these things, B is a constant in each cell, you get the following expression. So if you do like a Fourier so expanding B on something possible, then you get something that looks like a relativistic Doppler effect given by the velocity of the two boundaries. so spanning in V, in W's expression. So if we integrate that now over very many cells, we end up with the following relation displayed by integrating this, by summing it over many different many cells and approximating the sum as a continuous interval. Then you can integrate up to get the redshift is given by this expression here, where gamma is a constant. And we find that along a principal axis, where we have alpha equals 1, because the trajectory is always moving in a radial direction then, we find that gamma is given by 1, so z is given by zf by w in this definition. And for random trajectories crossing many spheres, we assume that they intersect cells at a random angle as they go through each one, and gamma is given by 2/3. And that was the dashed line that I showed you on the plot before. So comparing this to numerical integration, comparing this relation to the numerical integration, you find that gamma is given more accurately by 7/10. So they're not too far apart. There's a difference of a few percent there. But I think this gives you some interpretation of where the redshift is coming from. This is kind of the redshift due to the velocity of the boundaries of the cell. So that's integrating trajectories and the redshifts and lattice space-time. When I look at the optics and the lattice as well. So to do this, we take the Sachs optical equations, which are the set of three equations, the three different variables, theta, which is the expansion of a fundamental of geodesics. Omega is the vorticity of the bundle, and sigma is a complex scalar, which tells you the shear. So for point-like objects, we can set omega to zero initially. If it's zero initially, it stays zero. So we've got two equations, one for the expansion, one for the shear. So the expansion is driven by the Ricci curvature, attracted before that tangent to the non-GD6. And the shear is driven by the Weyl tensor. So in Schwarzschild space-time, after photons are propagating between singularities, then space-time is Ricci flat, it's empty. So there's no driving term here. But there's a non-zero Weyl curvature given by this expression, where J is the angular momentum constant. And psi is a constant as well. This is related to these vectors T, which specify a set of axes that you propagate along the null trajectories. So normally it's sufficient to set psi to zero if you put a globally Schwarzschild space-time, but we need to keep this in the equations now because we're moving from between different Schwarzschild regions. So the same thing, this is the opposite of the FRW case. So in FRW, you've got a Ricci curve space-time. So you've got a driving term for the expansion scale here, but you've got zero bar curvature, so you've got associate. So by assuming an averaging from speed objects to FRW, you're turning on one source and turning off the other. The angular diameter distance and the loss of distance are then given in terms of these quantities by the integral of the expansion scalar gives you the angular diameter distance, and then the luminosity distance is given by conservation energy, where the Lucas theorem with two packs of redshift. So, as well as propagating the trajectories between cells, we also want to propagate the optical scalars between cells as well. So, to do this, it's useful to write the shear, the complex shear, in this way, so the magnitude and its complex phase. And the two angles, phi and psi, which was the angle for the driving term of the shearing before, specify then the direction of the shear and the direction of shearing. So these aren't necessarily the same things anymore, because as you move between cells, the bundle of geodesics will have accumulated some shear from the previous cells, and as you move into a new cell, the new direction of shearing isn't necessarily the same as the previously accumulated shear. So so as you move through the boundary, the shearing angle, which is given by the direction towards the central mass in terms of these screen vectors T, changes and is effectively randomized as you move between different cells. the magnitude of the shear therefore takes a kind of approximate random walk as it travels through many cells, so that the bundle gets squashed in different directions as it goes through. If you're moving in an off-axis way. and the results are listed at the bottom. So the effect of shear is the brightest objects. And if we consider two example trajectories to a lattice here, then the solid line is a trajectory that experiences very little shear, even up to redshifts of beyond 2. And the dotted line, especially the dotted line, is a trajectory that experiences much greater shear. So in particular, it passes very close by to an object at z is 0.2, and again, just after z is 1. And with the shear scale, it jumps at those 2 points, and takes kind of a random walk away from them. And as the shear jumps, you get a brightening of the object. So trajectories are passed by the central masses, close by to the central masses here, get sheared significantly.
So what's the difference between these two trajectories in terms of the geometry that they're in the lattice? How does it look like?
So where is it?
From there.
So the black line is going to go nowhere near central mass, so every point it's going to be some distance away from each of the masses. Whereas the dotted line, say just after z is 0.2, is going to go very close by to one of the masses. As it goes close by, it experiences a lot of shear, and that shear causes brightening.
So you actually trace the trajectory through the whole lattice. So if it deflects basically, then you actually track that, right?
Yeah. Okay. So what we find is that in fact the dotted line here, where we get two very strong shearing events, relatively low z, is quite unusual. It's very unusual to experience that much shear at low z. The black line is a much better representation of a typical trajectory, at least up to z is 0.1. The further you go to higher and higher redshifts, the more likely you are to experience the shearing event, of course. But the black line is more typical for redshifts below about 1. And to quantify this, we look at the redshift at which the shear comes to dominate the optics. And we find that it depends on the scale of the lattice. And we've got here on the x-axis is the size of each lattice cell today, L0, and the Hubble rate today. So this gives you a dimensionless quantity. It specifies the size of the cell. And z-critical is a measure of the redshift at which deviation from an unsheared trajectory becomes appreciable. So the definition we use for that is the second derivative of RA vanishes. So that happens about here, this trajectory. So for that measure of deviation from an unchanged trajectory, we find that the critical value of redshift decreases as you make the cell sizes larger. And Milky Way size masses, like the ones we're considering, and probabilistic value of H0, LH is about 10 to the minus 4, so about here. And a third of the trajectories begin to diverge at Z is about 2.8. Below z equals 1 for this type of lattice, you find this a very good approximation to neglect shear entirely in typical trajectories. So this now depends on the size of sample that you're going to take. So if you take an infinitely large sample, you're going to get some trajectories that are sheared a lot. But if you've got a finite size sample of tens of supernovae in redshift 0.1, then we think it's going to be a good approximation to neglect shear. Below z equals 1. And for a typical trajectory, at low z, we find that the luminosity distance is well modeled by this result. And we expand that in terms of z, looks like this. And you can compare that to FRW values. And you can see that the deceleration parameter here is different from the corresponding FRW universe, which would be Einstein and Sitterman. But approaches it as gamma goes to 1. So in terms of a distance modulus block. So distance modulus is the logarithm of the numerosity distance. So if you find a trajectory in this part of the diagram that I correspond to accelerating expansion, if you interpret it in terms of FRW geometry, if you find it in this part of the diagram, it corresponds to decelerating expansion, and the line that separates them is an open empty nil first. So the lines in this plot, the dashed line is an Einstein Titter universe, the dot dashed line is Titter space, and for a typical trajectory that looks like this, you find the black line. So it's a deviation away from the Einstein Titter value. And it actually looks a bit dimmer at the same redshift. If you take gamma equals 1, so if you were to look along the principal axis of the lattice, then you'd find a shift in the opposite direction, which is what the dotted line is here. So initially this looks like it makes the problem of dark energy worse, because things are looking dimmer at the same redshift, whereas lambda makes them look a bit brighter.
And what is
the dotted line? The dotted line is if you look along the principal axis of the lattice.
What is BM?
Distance modulus.
So brighter is...
Brighter is upwards.
Ah, the last part of that. Your
chart, thanks. This is difference between a pair and an absolute range.
So delta DM is log to the base 10 of luminosity distance over the corresponding distance in the universe. Yeah, so it's the magnitude minus the magnitude.
So,
I think it might be a factor, a numerical factor in this.
You started by saying that if you take n large enough, you get FRW.
It looks dynamically like FRW. Dynamically, it expands like FRW, but the optical properties don't
emerge. Isn't that strange? Either you have it or you don't.
No, not necessarily. So, that's why the first slide was saying that even if you did a coarse grained approximation to a fine grained space time, I think dynamically like FRW, doesn't guarantee the optics look like FRW.
Sorry, can you think clearer again? The positive delta PM is accelerating?
Sorry, I didn't hear that.
You said a positive side of the plot is accelerating?
Yeah, so the Titter space accelerates, so it's up here.
So you're saying it still would not explain supernova?
No, so we have cosmological constant, it actually makes things worse. So it doesn't look like a good candidate for explaining all of dark energy. But if we do include lambda into this picture, then what we get is that the redshift, I'm not going to go through it again, the redshift behaves in a similar way to FRW with a factor of gamma up here. But gamma now runs with value of ZFRW. With two constants A and B. A increases as we increase the value of omega lambda from the value that we found with omega lambda equals 0, so 0.7, up to 1 as we increase omega lambda to 1. And B, so this is the running with FRW, is a smaller number, but it's non-zero as long as omega lambda is greater than 0 but less than 1. So what we find, in fact, is that when omega lambda goes to 1, we get the usual results that A goes to 1 and B goes to 0. So gamma goes to 1, we still the usual FRW redshift relation, which we should have, because the space-time is approaching the Titter space, the discretization of the massive supercover relative, and it does. So this is kind of reassuring that we haven't introduced any obvious errors, because it's approaching the right limit as it gets to the Titter space.
So if you take any homogeneous cosmology and you average it, you don't get FR, you get additional contribution to FRW, which can be identified with deviations from Einstein distance. The similar thing happens. This is what you're saying.
I make it a back reaction.
You average the grain, coarse grain average, and you don't get FRW.
You needn't get FRW because of back reaction effects.
Yeah.
But we don't find a significant deviation in a dynamical behavior, at least. So we don't find, I think that's called strong factor action. We don't find a noticeable strong factor action effect, but we do find a noticeable weak factor action effect, which is the difference in the object properties before and after averaging.
So this throws doubt on the whole FRW thing, because you start with a continuum FRW. You're saying if you do this thing with the lattice, to the averaging and so on, you don't get FRW. As far as these.
Well, for this simple system. Model, I mean, the universe doesn't look like discrete masses, and there's some approximations, but yes.
Yeah.
As far as
Friedman equation is
valid,
it's still valid, that's what he says.
Yeah.
But Friedman equation is not the part that one. The part I think is observable. So nobody really measures Friedman equation.
Yeah. So if we carry on the analysis, that was the relation. The optical relations now, the driving terms look exactly the same as they did before. You should expect this because the Ricci curvature is given proportional to the cosmological constant times the metric as the null vector. So that shouldn't contribute to that. And similarly, we get the driving term for the shear is being exactly the same. So the optical properties in terms of the shearing and expansion of the bundle of LGD seems to be very similar to before, with or without lambda. And the luminosity distance is then given as this expression. Doing well modified this expression. So F here is the side geometric function, the outer side of the geometric function, which is given in terms of gamma over gamma z. What that looks like on a Hubble diagram is the following. So it's this solid line. If we do a best fit to the first year, that's an inverse theta, which is these supernovae here, plus some supernova lower z as well, to anchor the Hubble diagram. So this is, say, 115 supernovae as the year. So we fitted this theta, and we've got the black line here. The blue line underneath is the best fit to lambda CEM with k equals 0. And the difference between those two bits is 0.37 in favor of lambda CEM.
What is the dashed line?
The dashed line, sorry, is the sitter space.
The sitter.
And this is Einstein's sitter.
And that's Einstein's sitter.
Yeah, just for reference. So this is done in usual ways by fitting the stretch and color parameters to the two models, as well as the intrinsic errors and the absolute magnitudes. For each discipline.
So you begin to see a deviation above 1.
Yeah. So below 1, or below about 0.8, the black line is on top of the blue line. But as you go to slightly larger, you see a little bit of a difference. That's where most of this comes from. This is a very small difference in
life. What happens if z equal to 2? 1.7.
Well, the difference grows, but the model becomes less reliable. The larger range is the same. Yeah. So I wouldn't really want to extrapolate it as much better.
That's the critical region.
For what?
That's the critical data. What's happening at
At the moment, there are very few supernovae beyond about 1. In the future, it might be 1. Yeah.
You're saying that this free lambda model is very consistent?
The fit that we get to the data is very good. So it's slightly worse than lambda CEM, but the point I want to make isn't that the bits almost as good. It's that the best fit value of lambda is different. So the best fit value of lambda for the blue line is the usual value that you get for fitting to this data set, which is 0.74 plus or minus 0.04. And the value for the lattice model is 0.66 plus or minus 0.04. So it's a difference of about 10% between the two of them. You need 10% less data with the last model. So this looks like it's about 2 sigma away. But in actual fact, if you can imagine if the data became better and better and was scattered around the same best fit models, then these errors would decrease, but the difference in the best fit value would stay the same, assuming the data scattered around the same.
So do you know what is the scatter? Have you found the scatter of this plot?
The scatter of the supernovae around the best fit?
Yeah.
Because,
I mean, I suspect that's going to be big. Well, the thing is, well, the big lensing is what, or lensing is basically what does people associate with this fact that basically they're going to either randomly brighten or dim the supernova. But then, since you have a very homogeneous universe on a small scale, in a sense, your potential is becomes, well, you have huge, these huge black holes, then I suspect you're going to get very lots of strong dancing.
No more than you would in all weekend, I think. I mean, you still got Milky Way side galaxies spaced about and it passed the great feature, not in this regular way, but blazing with a black hole doesn't mean you get more shearing. It's still the same mass, as long as you're not getting very close to it, which most trajectories don't.
I just suspect that the scatter around this is going to be bigger than usual, but yeah, I see your point that it's not very different from the usual.
Yeah, and this is a bigger difference than you get from the kinds of difference as well, mainly due to this sort of changing redshift.
Yeah.
So, in conclusion, the optical properties of coarse-grained cosmological models are not necessarily the same as the fine-grained space-times they're designed to obtain. So we've investigated a lattice of regular discrete masses and found that it dynamically it behaves very much like FRW, but the optical properties are different. The optical and dynamical properties of space-time do not approach continuous limit in the same way. We find that they approach the continuous limit applied the same way. Well, then what I mean by this is, as you increase the number of cells, the scale of the dynamical expansion approaches the FRW expansion in a smooth way, but the optical properties don't seem to. So, some of the effects I've talked about do approach the FRW value as the cells become very small, but the redshift effect in particular seems to be relatively independent of the cell size, as long as the cells are larger than the wavelength of the photons, at which point geometric optics breaks down anyway. I find that redshifts can be altered from their FRW values and by quite large amounts. I find that in the absence of shear, dimming can occur as a function of time or brightening as a function of redshift. The black line I showed you on the distance modulus plot without lambda was lower on that plot, meaning it was dimmer at the same redshift. If you consider a function of cosmological time, it would actually be where the dotted line was. So it would be brighter at the same time, but dimmer at the same redshift. And there's a difference here, even as the continuous limit is approached, continually break geometric optics. Some trajectories are strongly affected by shear, optical scaling is convergent on those trajectories. We find that by comparing to the data, if we include lambda, the simplest application of this model gives about a 10% shift in value of omega lambda. So you need about 10% less lambda to shift than the data for simpler data. So although this model isn't adequate to describe sufficiently accurate devices to calculate CFD observations, if these effects continue to higher redshifts with a more adequate model, then they could have significant impact on CMB observations, and this could be a very good way to constrain the geometry of the universe, because the CMB is very sensitive to angular time to distance in the position of the acoustic spectral. And if you want to do precision cosmology, well, then understanding the sub-effect can be an influence. So this is an ongoing work, like I say, we're working on evaluating the approximations you find to it and looking at different limits of it. This is the work that's it.
You mentioned this, but I just wanted to hear it again. You showed us the first plot that showed it was the effective inhomogeneity made it dimmer, but then it led to less lambda. And briefly mentioned why that was. Why are those two effects in the opposite direction?
So what happens is that the redshift the redshift is smaller than it is in FRW. So this isn't exactly what's happening, but you're kind of squashing the plot to the left of it. So if you're above the middle of the line here, you get the curve squashed to the left.
So
then
which,
you go below it, you get.
So the plot you had before, the one where it was actually lower, that what was on the X? That was, so you're saying those Zs are different?
No, this is redshift.
But I mean, which redshift? FRW redshift or actual?
Actual redshift in the model.
Okay, so then I don't understand why. I still don't understand why this would be dimmer. and then, but you end up with needing less land depth.
So if I didn't include dimension to effect at all, so I set gamma equals to 1, then you get the dotted line there. So the effect of changing gamma away from 1 is to kind of move you away from this horizontal line. Because redshifts become smaller, so you get squashed this way. So at this point, we can do something else.
Q naught goes negative.
Sorry?
Q naught goes negative as gamma increases.
Well, gamma is below 1, so we're finding it's 7/10 when lambda is 0.
So would it actually be?
It's at 1 for omega lambda is 1 and decreases.
So are you saying, sorry, do you like that? So you're saying that if instead of doing your solid and dotted lines around this Einstein visitor, would they be a mirror image on the visitor side?
No. So the effect actually disappears when you go to the cis space because the effect of discreteness of the masses goes to 0. So A goes to 1, B goes to 0, gamma goes to 1. So the effect of, if you've got masses that are irrelevant for the space-type geometry, then it doesn't matter if they're discrete or not. Lambda's never discrete, as always.
Right, so this is, again, confusing, because we live in a universe that's fairly close to us. So it's getting closer. So why does this effect make us seem like we have one?
The effect disappears as omega lambda goes to 1, but if you've got omega lambda is about 46 or so, you've still got a sizable effect.
So, again, so can you give an intuitive reason why it appears to make, like, it makes us seem further from consider them?
I can give you an intuitive reason for the different effects I was talking about. So for the redshift, the redshift here looks more like a relativistic Doppler shift because of the relative motion of the boundaries of each cell when you integrate over lots of cells. You get a smaller redshift than the cosmological one, which is you assume an isotropic expansion around each point. The expansion here is maximized in the direction orthogonal to the boundaries. So if you're actually moving in an angle between them, then it doesn't pick up the full.
Okay, so we have a vector expansion. So, I'm sorry, I'm being slow. So we have a fixed redshift that goes off, a fixed supernova that goes off at some fixed ruler distance from us. What you're saying is that if we calculate its luminosity distance in your model, you'll get a different and smaller answer for its redshift than the standard cosmology.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that which means that, but its brightness will be this.
If there's no lambda, the brightness is dimmer at the same redshift.
So the same redshift is dimmer, but in fact the redshift is smaller. So that's actually a bright.
At the same time, it's brighter.
Yeah, I don't. I'm sorry.
So it adds up to being effectively brighter.
It depends on variable. But it's brighter as a function of time, dimmer as a function of redshift in the absence of time. Because of the time redshift relation.
Yeah, it's bigger. That's what gives DM.
DM is bigger, so what?
The question is whether DM is bigger or smaller.
Why, if they're both as a function of redshift, why does the effect of adding the homogeneity cause DM to be negative in this plot?
There's no lambda in this one.
There's no lambda.
Oh, yeah, sorry. There's no lambda. This is about lambda. All up to this point, there's been no lambda in it.
Okay.
And then we include lambda. And then when we fit to the model, fit to the data with allowing lambda to vary, then we find this is the best fit for the model, which has got a lower omega lambda than the F1. So this plots with lambda, fits to the data, and the other one's without any lambda.
So that seems kind of strange that if you don't have lambda, you eventually end up with something with dimmer supernova. But then if you do have lambda, you need less of it.
You expect more.
Yeah, I would expect it to go in the other direction.
Yeah. So as I was saying, the reason for that is that the the redshift, you say if you take a particular supernova, then the redshift to that supernova is less in the analysis model. So if you took an FRW model with this value of open and under, then the curve would be a bit higher at this center. And then if you move each of those points to lower Z,
So it's a bit deceiving to be plotting these on the same Z axis.
What?
Okay,
but
you just said that the Z's are not the same.
Yeah.
This is for the FRW model. This is the redshift you'd see in the FRW model. For the lattice model, this is the redshift you'd see in the lattice model. It's the observed
redshift.
Right. It's the observed redshift. But the distance that you would calculate is different.
I see.
But it's an observed.
Well, the thing that's not clear is what is the definition of omega lambda in your.
We take that from the dynamical expansion, you have the different terms. So we had R dot squared equals a matter term and this Kirch term. And then when you include lambda, there's a lambda term also. So you took omega lambda as being the
Friedman equation?
As the equation looks like a Friedman equation.
Well, but isn't that misleading? Because the Friedman equation, we decided it doesn't describe anything. Because the redshift is, Friedman redshift is different from the observed.
What method is omega method?
Is
omega method?
Well, but I mean, how do you define omega
method? This is omega method as defined by the dynamical expansion.
But we don't observe the non-public. I mean, it doesn't have any physical significance. So.
No. You can that's the if you want to define how much lambda you've got.
But like I said, so in this it's not clear what is matter in this model because. I mean, you have a sharp.
Necessarily means we have less matter or more matter, right? Because still, we don't have any other.
It's expanding like a universe, like an FRW universe, with this value of omega lambda as well.
Yeah, but I'm saying that all the measurements of omega lambda do not come directly from the expansion that they come from.
No, but that's what this means. Though. This means the lattice universe is expanding like an FRW universe with this value of omega lambda.
Yeah, that's.
In particle physics, you have lattice models. And one of the problems is that when you take the continuum limit, you don't get the rates and variance. And so you can lose rotational variance. This has always been a problem. So that if you take the continuum limit here, it's not clear that you get the correct local symmetry. So it's not clear to me whether the difference you're getting is due to that or due to something in nature.
Right, well, in the diagram here, in the plot, this isn't a continuum limit. This is with masses and sizes.
But then you don't have rotational variance in FRW here. A significant deviation effect. This has to have an effect in nature. You don't get the continuum limit, then you don't have the right model.
In terms of the optical properties, you wouldn't want to trust this model below the wavelength of the photons. Anyway, but if you're talking about the space-time itself, modeling the space-time is fine. So it's not an exact model, that's true. So as you take the limit of continuous space time, it might be something strange. I'm not sure exactly how that would work. But in terms of a large scale model with megaparsec sized cells, I mean,
it's not clear to me that what you're seeing is due to the deficiency in the model, or whether it's really replicating nature.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Eventually, you have SO3,1 symmetry. It's very exact.
But you have that at any point here as well.
No, you don't have SO3. You have galaxies. You have galaxies. So that they don't have SO3.
The FRW model is the
continuum
model.
But the whole point is that you don't have FRW. If you had an FRW, then everything was fine. But the problem is, how do you quantify deviations from the FRW? Exactly.
Okay. What are those deviations?
Well, I mean, this model is just a lattice. So
it means you're breaking local horizon.
But
it's
your spontaneous
driving
the same way that you and I are breaking. So that's okay.
Yeah, but I don't mind breaking open a race convention, but people do that everywhere. Here, I don't do it anymore. Maybe I do. Anyway.
You are. You're in existence. You are.
I'm responsible for all of it. But when you're doing this calculation, you're going to have significant breaking of local signatures.
Well, you're breaking FOW signatures, certainly.
Yeah, but that's serious.
That's what nature does.
We've got galaxies in the universe. There are galaxies there and there and there. I mean, the Arrhenius model is that he has the galaxies all evenly spaced, nicely equidistant apart.
You could argue about how the model is based type, but there should be a solution to Einstein's equations that has regularly spaced discrete mass symmetry. That shouldn't be a problem. I mean, finding a metric for that exactly is impossibly difficult.
It's the effort that we match is rotation away. It's R cross O3. O3 is the rotation. So I bet you when you do the limit, take the limit, you're going to find you don't have O3 symmetry.
But you see, John, the problem is not we don't want to approximate FRW universe. The question is, the problem is all the way around. FRW is an approximation, and it turns out that it's a bad approximation.
But there's no observational breaking of O3 symmetry back to a ratio of 2.
Well, on a small scale, there is. The fact that you have galaxies, that you have Andromeda galaxy in one direction and other direction you don't have. So that's a megaparsec from us. So that the megaparsec scale, which is the size of this lattice, is the O3 symmetry.
And we have O3 symmetry out to Z of order 1. Observation.
Well, on very large scales you do, but on a small scale you don't.
It does?
No. We can discuss this later.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So just basically the fixed rho m at redshift of 0 and then define is that for both cases compare between the two.
There's no energy density.
So in one oh. So because in your lattice you mentioned you fixed the mass of the cell.
We fixed the central masses to be local base size.
And then the lattice
and we fixed the lattice size to be 1 megaparsec today.
So
and we take the Hubble rate.
So that fixes your omega matter, doesn't it? That fixes something.
It fixes. You get a different energy mass depending on how much lambda you put in. There's no local energy density for it to define.
I'm saying you have fixed the mass distribution at redshift of 0 and to make the comparison between the lambda CBM with FRW, is it the same mass distribution at redshift 0? And how sensitive is it to your 10% difference to changing this? I don't know.
Okay, so if you make the cell, I'll just talk about without lambda. If you make the cells very small, and if you consider an on-axis trajectory, so the redshift effect is there, then this dotted line approaches Einstein's center, but the redshift effect doesn't change significantly. So this black line will change in the same way. It'll move because the shear becomes negligible, and the shear starts accumulating in a way that looks like the focusing through matter in the So the optical properties, the optical scalars approach those FRW, the redshift relation doesn't change significantly.
How can you
promote
this as a historical field when you have done that? Are you sure you can't control the system only under control that is that is approximation?
These are certainly including this error. There's liable to be another error in the approximations that we're working on evaluating what IST coverage. Basically, it's a more difficult thing to do than just fake the data.
I was just thinking that the systematic is pretty complicated.
Well, there's some reasons to think that the errors in that the approximations of this model are good. I mean, because of the different matching conditions of the boundary we use, we found there's quite a small difference between those relationships. So that's encouraging. We find that we get the sitter space in the right limit, which hopefully means we haven't introduced any big errors at least from making this lattice. And we've got an analytic approximation that gives us something reasonably close to the numerical results. So that kind of
well, the thing that's very puzzling is that in our universe today, the deviations from Friedman is 10 to the minus 5, essentially, because 5, the metric perturbations are 10 to the minus 5. So what's puzzling is how you can get from 10 to the minus 5 to 10%.
So you're assuming that you've got FRW backgrounds,
etc. Well, but, I mean, that's my point. The deviations from FRW background are essentially the metric perturbations.
If you assume that you have an FRW background.
Well, but I mean, you can measure deviations there from that.
No, but the you could be shifting things by much more if it's not full proper. Right? Because you make all the assumptions in FRW about the optical properties. What this shows is those optical properties could
Well, I mean, that's in principle that's supposed to that's the question we want to answer. But I mean, the thing that sounds not quite right about this is that how you get from 10 to the minus 5
the space time is increased to FRW at any point. So, if you're talking about linear perturbed FRW universe, then you're starting off with FRW metric. This is specifically time dependent,
yeah,
in the spatial part, and in fixed perturbation part. This is. In no point a linear perturbation of FRW, you haven't got a time dependent metric at any point. Inside, you've got a source of space on which you can write in the static element.
Is that the correct assessment at no point? I mean, I agree that close to the singularity is not close to FRW, but if you're far away from the singularity, aren't you close to FRW?
Well, if you affect off the associated, the gravitational influences, the strength is metric around you, then you've got exactly the source of
but of course, you.
Perturbation of FRW. So
this is not a spherical in any case. There is no spherical symmetry here, so that doesn't tell us anything.
But if you take that as an example, I think. If you have a space cheese model like an Einstein Strauss vacuole, you put a point like mass in a vacuum with an appropriate boundary in FRW universe, the space time inside the boundary is Schwarzschild, which isn't the perturbation of FRW.
Starship could be a perturbation of FRW. Depending on where you're, not everywhere, but somewhere it could be. So
stays away from the horizon.
Away from the horizon, it could be. I mean, GM over R. So if you're far away from the horizon, it could be very close to flat at least. So that's the thing. It seems to me that unless you're very close to the horizon, you should be close to FRW. But then I don't see any magic can get to 10%. So either you get, there are.
I don't understand how do you compare the FRW, which is the theater.
Right, it's not a straightforward, but.
But I think the point is what you normally do is a self consistency.
Yeah, exactly.
You assume FRW. And then we look at how big the fluctuations are, and we find the small things there, and okay, so it's good. So then it's very difficult to see how you can get such a big difference.
But that's the point, because you're assuming the Tony perturbation theory, which is valid in between galaxies. But these galaxies are spikes. So when you try to add them up, that's the problem.
But even inside galaxies.
So what you're saying is not necessarily valid. That's the whole point.
No, it's self-consistent. So it's, make assumption.
Yeah.
You test the assumption if that works.
Well, you make another assumption if it doesn't work.
You
can make any assumption you want, and then you test that assumption, you find the corrections to it, and if they're small, the assumption, the original assumption is good. Mm-hmm. Right? So, and that's what we normally do. That's what I mentioned saying. That
the
only we assume that, and we find the corrections, the 10 to the minus 5. Mm-hmm. How do you get beyond
that? So, here is the question. So, it's not clear to me that they are out of the. So I started a Friedman universe, so I accept the picture until I start having the halos and galaxies. And now that I have them, instead of using my Friedman universe to calculate the potential, I use this method to calculate the potentials. Now,
but this is a toy model. I'm not advocating like a strict change. I mean, so even at last gathering, if you've got dark matter particles instead of an actual continuous energy density, if you've got those particles separated by a meter, then the space time between doesn't take a continuous energy density. It's not actually FRW.
That's
yeah. But all I'm saying is that is there so would I get a consistent answer if I calculate the potentials?
You should do. If you keep winding this back in time, the masses will get closer and closer together. They'll start looking more and more like a Freeman universe dynamically, but that doesn't mean locally between the masses, it's still the same. It's still not if I don't use space time.
So if the local look the same, the trick is the same, then this should stay the same, whatever the optical method.
Well, I mean, I don't think this is a principle, I don't think there's anything in principle wrong with it. That's why I'm surprised that there's this big difference between the FRW. Because on the one hand, I think this should be a good approximation for FRW because potentials are small, basically. And one megaparsec fires them to the minus 5. On one hand, I think that this is very close to FRW, so it should give you something similar. But then on the other hand, you're saying you've done this and you get something very different. So that's the dilemma.
Sure. I think the main difference is, say, even with linear people at FRW, the expansion is still approximately isostructural because any small deviation is made by substrate at each point. So you get a stretching, it's a stretching and wavelength at each point. As but being approximately isostructural, you still have. When you go to these lattice, the expansion isn't isostructural anymore. It's another background file, but not the motivations to not holding a background in terms of.
But you can always think of this as FRW plus a large.
But it's not a large perturbation.
It's
a small perturbation. You can always think.
Delta rho arose is 5, 10 with the
calculus. But that's not delta rho. It's
10 to the minus 5 in between.
It's a metric, it's a potential that matters. That's not delta rho over rho.
That's my question. All that matters here, I can just forget about the matter density. All that matters is that because photons are following the potentials, geodetics, it seems like then phi of TMX should be different in two different approaches, right? From the point of view.
Why TMX?
In the potential.
Well, it depends what is the potential. It's the background, it's the potential on top of it. So this is trying to measure the A of T, not the phi on top of the A of T.
But what gives us the optimal measurement is the phi of this phi.
So, well, if you're doing calculation in FRW space time, then you get that's a proportion to phi minus psi. But this isn't attempting to model the linear perturbations on top of the FRW background.
No, I agree. But what I'm saying is that if I'm a photon going through this lattice, all I see is the gravitational potential.
So the red shift in linear FRW doesn't come from the perturbations; it comes from the background expansion, mostly. Whereas here, there is no background expansion.
So it's only.
So the course grading says you try to use Newtonian perturbation theory to get your argument. But this is a controversy going on between the inhomogeneous people and non
But I don't think it's a controversy that the nonlinear terms are 10 to the minus 5, so that.
This is. The argument is probably false.
Sorry, what is that?
The argument that you can use Newtonian perturbation to get 10 to the minus 5 is considered by some people like George Ellis to be false.
So I suspect that that's
you can
the
show
discussion.
Why it's false.
Okay, so that sounds like something that we should discuss, but I don't think we should take everybody on the hostage for that. But let's thank him again.